Chapter 10
"Happiness," said Schwartz, "how its colors run in your memory, like cheap shirts in the laundry. Only unhappy people can count. We went to Paris and found rooms in a small hotel on the Quai du Grand Augustin, on the left bank of the Seine. There was no elevator, the stairs were warped and worn with age, and the rooms were small. But we had a view of the Seine, the bookstalls on the quay, the Palais de Justice in Notre Dame. We had passports. We were human beings until September 1939. We were human beings until September, and it made no difference whether our passports were genuine or not. But it made a difference when the phony war began. What did you live on when you were here before? Helen asked me one day. Were you allowed to work? Of course not. I wasn't even allowed to exist. How would you expect a non-existent person to get a work permit?
What did you live on then?
I don't remember, I answered truthfully. I worked at various trades. None of the jobs lasted very long. The French are no great sticklers for legality. You can always find something to do if you'll accept low wages. I loaded crates at Les Halles. I waited on table. I peddled ties, socks, and shirts. I gave German lessons. Once in a while, the refugee committee gave me a little something. I sold my belongings. I wrote some short articles for Swiss newspapers.
Couldn't you get a newspaper job again?
No, for that you need working papers and a residence permit. My last job was addressing letters. Then came Schwartz and my apocryphal existence.
Why apocryphal?
Because I was supposed to be someone else, living under the cover of a dead man's name. I'd ceased to exist as myself.
I wish you'd call it something else, said Helen.
It doesn't much matter what I call it. A double life, a borrowed life, or a second life. Yes, maybe that's the most accurate. We're like castaways who have no regrets, because they've lost their memory. It's memory that makes people feel that they've lost the good things without improving the bad ones. Helen laughed.
What are we now? Imposters, corpses, or ghosts?
Legally, we are tourists. We are allowed to be here, but not to work.
Fine, she said, then we won't work. Let's go to the Île Saint-Louis and sit on a beach in the sun. Then we'll go to the Café de France and eat on the sidewalk. How's that for a program?
It's a fine program, I said. And we stuck to it. I stopped looking for odd jobs. For weeks on end, we were together from early morning to early morning. Out in the world, time stormed by. Extras, troop movements, emergency sessions of the chamber. But all that had nothing to do with us. It simply wasn't there. We were living in eternity. When your world is brimful of feeling, there's no room for time. You're on another shore, beyond time. Or don't you believe that?
Schwartz turned to me with a look of desperate appeal.
You don't believe it?
He asked. I was tired and, I couldn't help it, impatient. Stories about happiness are without interest, and Schwartz's fantasies about eternity left me pretty cold, too.
I don't know, I answered absently. Maybe happiness or eternity comes when we die. Then the calendar stops, and time with it. But if we go on living, there's no help for it. Whatever we do takes place in time, and time passes.
I won't let it die! Said Schwartz with sudden violence. I want it to stand still like a marble statue, not like a castle of sand that washes away in the tide. What would become of the dead whom we love? What would become of them? Wouldn't they die over and over again? Where else are they, if not in our memory? Her face! I'm the only one who still knows it. Can I leave it to the ravages of time?
I know it will fade, even in my mind. It will be distorted and falsified unless I can project it and set it up outside of me. The lies and fantasies of my mind will entwine it like ivy and destroy it, and in the end there will be nothing left but ivy. I know that. That's why I have to save my memory from myself, from the corrosive egotism that will make me try to forget so that I can go on living. Don't you understand?
I understand, Mr. Schwartz, I said, treading as softly as I could. That's why you are talking to me, to save your memory from yourself. I was annoyed with myself for having spoken so bluntly before. The man was mad, with a logical madness, a Don Quixote, determined to battle the windmills of time, and I had too much respect for his grief to try to analyze his condition.
If I succeed...
Schwartz could not go on. Then he took a fresh start.
If I succeed, it will be safe against anything I can do. You believe me?
Yes, Mr. Schwartz. Our memory is not an ivory casket in a dusty museum. It is an animal that lives and eats and digests. It consumes itself like the phoenix in the legend so that we can go on living and not be destroyed by it. That's what you are trying to prevent.
That's it!
Schwartz's eyes were full of gratitude.
You said that memory can turn to stone only if we die. That's what I am going to do.
I was talking nonsense, I said wearily. I hated such conversations. I had known so many neurotics. Exile produces them as rain produces mushrooms.
I'm not going to take my life, said Schwartz, and smiled, as though he knew what I was thinking. Human lives are too much needed right now. I'm only going to die as Joseph Schwartz. Tomorrow morning, when I leave you, Joseph Schwartz will be dead.
A thought passed through my mind, and with it a wild hope. What are you going to do? I asked.
Disappear.
As Joseph Schwartz?
Yes.
Just the name?
Everything that was Joseph Schwartz is going to disappear. My former self.
What will you do with your passport?
I won't be needing it.
Have you another?
Schwartz shook his head. I don't need one.
Is there an American visa in it?
Yes.
Would you sell it to me? I asked, though I had no money.
Schwartz shook his head.
Why not?
I can't sell it, said Schwartz. I received it as a present. But I can give it to you. Tomorrow morning. Can you use it?
Good Lord, I said breathlessly. Use it? It would save my life. There's no American visa in mine, and I have no idea how I'd get one by tomorrow.
Schwartz smiled sadly. How things repeat themselves. You remind me of the time when Schwartz was dying. I sat in his room and I couldn't think of anything but that passport that would make me a human being again.
Fine. I'll give you mine.
You'll only have to change the picture. The age must be about right.
39, I said.
You'll be 5 years older. Have you got somebody who's good with passports?
Yes, I replied. I know a man here. It's easy to change the picture.
Schwartz nodded. Easier than a personality.
He stared into space for a moment.
Wouldn't it be strange if you were to develop an interest in paintings? Like Schwartz, and then myself?
A shudder ran through me. A passport is a piece of paper, I said. It's not magic.
No, said Schwartz.
Well, yes, I answered, but not that way. How long did you stay in Paris? I was in such a turmoil over Schwartz's promise to give me his passport that I didn't hear what he said. I could think only about what I would have to do to get a visa for Ruth, I could try to pass her off as my sister, but it probably wouldn't work. They were very strict at American consulates. I'd have to try, though, unless a second miracle happened. Then I heard Schwartz speaking. One day he turned up in our room in Paris, he said. It had taken him 6 weeks, but he found us. This time he didn't send somebody from the German consulate. He came in person, and there he stood in the hotel room with the 18th-century pastoral prince, Georg Jürgens, Obersturmbannführer, Helen's brother, tall, broad-shouldered, 200 pounds or over, and 10 times as German as in Osnabrück, despite his civilian clothes. He glared at us. So it was all lies, he said. I thought there was something fishy. That shouldn't surprise you, I said. It stinks wherever you go. I wonder why. Helen laughed.
Stop laughing, Georg shouted. Stop shouting, I said, or I'll have you thrown out. Why don't you try to do it yourself?
I shook my head. Are you still playing the hero when there's no danger? You outweigh me by 20 pounds. Nobody would put us in the ring together. What do you want?
That's none of your business, you goddamned traitor. Get out. I want to talk to my sister.
Stay right here, said Helen to me. She was bristling with rage. Slowly she rose from her chair and picked up a marble ashtray. One more word in that tone and you'll get this in your face, she said very calmly. This isn't Germany.
No, unfortunately, but never mind. It soon will be.
Never, cried Helen. Maybe you armed robots will conquer it for a while, but it will still be France. Is that what you've come here to talk about?
I've come here to take you home. Don't you know what will happen to you if the war catches you here?
Not much.
They'll put you in prison.
Helen was taken aback for a moment. Maybe they'll put us in a camp, I said. But it will be an internment camp, not a concentration camp as in Germany.
What do you know about it?
Georg sneered.
Plenty,
I answered. I was in one of yours, thanks to you.
You worm! You were in a rehabilitation camp, said Georg contemptuously. But it didn't do you any good. The moment you were released, you deserted.
I admire your terminology, I said. If anyone escapes from your clutches, it's desertion.
What else would you call it? Your orders were not to leave Germany.
I made a disparaging gesture. I had had enough talks of this kind with Georg before he had the power to lock me up. Georg always was an idiot, said Helen. A weakling with big muscles. He needs his armored philosophy as a fat woman needs a corset, because without it he wouldn't have any shape at all. Don't argue with him. He makes a lot of noise because he's weak.
Cut it out, said Georg more peaceably than I had expected. Pack your things, Helen. The situation is serious. We're taking the train tonight.
How serious?
There's going to be war. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here.
You'd be here anyway, said Helen. Just the same as you were in Switzerland 2 years ago when I didn't want to go back. It's upsetting to a loyal party man to have a sister who doesn't want to live in Germany. You persuaded me to go back, but this time I'm staying right here, and there's no point in talking about it.
Georg glared at her. Because of this miserable scoundrel? I suppose he talked you into it.
Helen laughed. Scoundrel? I haven't heard that word in a long time. It sounds like the Middle Ages. No, this scoundrel, my husband, didn't talk me into anything. He actually did his best to send me back, for better reasons than yours.
I want to speak to you alone, said Georg.
It won't do you any good.
You're my sister.
I'm a married woman.
That's not a blood relationship, said Georg.
Then suddenly he took the tone of an offended child.
You haven't even offered me a chair. Here I come all the way from Osnabrück, and you don't even ask me to sit down. Helen laughed. This isn't my room. My husband pays the rent.
Be seated, Obersturmbannführer and minion of Hitler, I said, but don't stay too long.
Georg gave me an angry look and sat down with a crash on the decrepit couch.
I'd like to speak to my sister alone. Can't you get that through your head?
Did you let me speak to her alone when you had me arrested? I asked him.
That was entirely different.
With Georg and his party comrades, what they do is always entirely different, said Helen. When they kill or arrest people for disagreeing with them, when they send you to a concentration camp, they are defending the besmirched honor of the fatherland. Am I right, Georg?
Exactly.
He's always right, Helen went on. Never any doubts, never any qualms of conscience. He's always on the right side where the power is. He's like his Führer, the most peace-loving man in the world as long as everybody does what he says. The others are always the troublemakers. Am I right, Georg?
What has that to do with us?
Nothing, said Helen. And everything. Don't you see how ridiculous your self-righteousness is in this city of tolerance? Even dressed as a civilian, you're always wearing boots to trample people with. But here you haven't any power, not yet. Here you can't enroll me in your sweaty, flat-footed National Socialist Women's Association. Here you can't treat me like a prisoner. Here I can breathe, and I mean to stay here and keep on breathing.
You have a German passport. There's going to be a war. You'll be sent to prison.
Not right away. Anyway, I'd rather be in prison here than in Germany, because you'd have to lock me up, too. It wouldn't be the same now that I've breathed the sweet air of freedom, now that I know what it's like to be away from you and your barracks and your human stud farms and your horrid shouting. I wouldn't be able to keep my mouth shut anymore.
I stood up. I couldn't stand to see her laying herself bare before this National Socialist vulgarian who would never understand her.
It's all his fault, Georg snarled. Damned cosmopolitan, he's corrupted you. You just wait, we'll settle your hash.
He stood up too. He could easily have beaten me up. He was twice my size, and the course in national rehabilitation they had put me through in the concentration camp had left me with a stiff elbow.
Don't you lay a finger on him, said Helen very softly.
The coward, said Georg. Why do you have to defend him? Can't he look after himself?
Schwartz turned to me. It's a curious thing about sheer physical brawn. We know it has nothing to do with courage or strength of character. A gun in the hand of a cripple can deflate the biggest bag of brawn and muscle. You know all that, and even so you feel humiliated because you can't stand up to one of these stupid bruisers. You know that it's not a contest of courage, that this bully is probably a perfect coward, but it doesn't do a particle of good. You look for excuses. You want to justify yourself. You feel like a worm because you don't want to be beaten to a pulp. You know what I mean? I nodded. We know how absurd it is, but that makes us feel even worse.
If he had attacked me, I'd have defended myself, said Schwartz. I swear I would have.
I raised my hand. Why do you say that, Mr. Schwartz? You don't have to explain these things to me.
He smiled feebly. I guess not. I'm still trying to justify myself. That shows how deep it goes. It's like a barb in the flesh. I wonder if we ever get over this male vanity.
What happened? I asked. Did you fight?
No. Helen began to laugh.
Will you look at that fool, she said to me. He thinks that if he beats you up, I'll see how unmanly you are. He thinks I'll repent and go back to the land where the fist reigns supreme.
She turned to Georg.
You have the gall to call my husband a coward. He's shown more courage than you can even conceive of. He came for me. He came back to Germany to bring me out.
What?
Georg's eyes nearly popped out of his head.
To Germany?
Helen recollected herself.
Forget it. I'm here and I'm not going back.
He came to get you?
Georg asked.
Who helped him?
Nobody, said Helen. You'd like to arrest a few people, wouldn't you?
I had never seen her like that, trembling with revulsion, hatred, and blazing triumph at having escaped from his clutches. I felt the same way, but another thought struck me with blinding force, the thought of revenge. Georg had no power here. He couldn't whistle for his Gestapo. He was alone. I was completely shaken. I had to do something, but I didn't know what. I couldn't fight, and I had no desire to. What I wanted was to blot this man out, to wipe him off the face of the earth, without a trial. You don't try an incarnation of evil, and that was how I felt about Georg. It wasn't just revenge. To destroy him would be to save dozens of unknown victims. I went to the door. I had no idea of what I was going to do. My head was reeling, and I was surprised that I didn't fall. I had to be alone. I had to think. Helen watched me closely, but said nothing. Georg eyed me with contempt and sat down again. At last, he growled, when I closed the door behind me. I went down the stairs. Smells rose from the kitchen, fish for lunch. There was an Italian chest on the next landing. I had passed any number of times and never noticed it. Now I examined the carvings as if I were planning to buy it. Then I continued on like a sleepwalker. On the third floor, a door was open. The room was painted light green, the windows were open, and the chambermaid was turning the mattress. Strange, all the things you notice when you're so excited you think you can't see a thing. I knocked at the door of a man I knew on the second floor. His name was Fischer, and he had once shown me his revolver. He kept it because it made life easier to bear. The possibility of putting an end to his godforsaken refugee's existence any time he pleased gave him the illusion that he was keeping on of his own free will. Fischer was out, but his room wasn't locked. He had nothing to hide. I went in to wait for him. I had no definite plan, but I knew I had to borrow that gun. It would be absurd to kill Georg in the hotel. That was plain to me. It would have endangered Helen and myself and the other refugees who lived there. I sat down in a chair and tried to calm myself. I didn't succeed. I just sat there, staring into space. A canary began to sing. It was in a wire cage hanging between the windows. I hadn't noticed it before and started as though someone had bumped into me. Then Helen came in.
What are you doing here?
She asked.
Nothing.
Where is Georg?
He's gone.
I didn't know how long I had been in Fischer's room. Not very long, it seemed to me.
Will he be back?
I asked.
I don't know. He's stubborn. Why did you go away? To leave us alone?
No, Helen, I said. I just couldn't stand the sight of him any longer. She stood in the doorway and looked at me.
Do you hate me?
Hate you? I asked in profound astonishment.
Why? The thought came to me after Georg had gone. If you hadn't married me, all this wouldn't have happened to you.
The same thing would have happened, or worse. Maybe in his own way Georg was easier on me for your sake. They didn't drive me into the electric barbed wire. They didn't hang me on a meat hook.
I hate you? How could you even think of such a thing? Suddenly I saw the green summertime through Fisher's windows. The room was in the rear. There was a chestnut tree in the court, and the sun filtered through the leaves. My hysteria seeped away like a hangover in the late afternoon. I was myself again. I knew what day of the week it was. I knew that it was summer outside, that I was in Paris, and that you don't shoot people down like rabbits. I could more easily imagine you hating me, I said, or despising me.
Despising you?
Yes, because I can't keep your brother away. Because I was silent. The minutes that had just passed were far away.
What are we doing here?
I asked, in this room. We went up the stairs. Everything Georg said is true, I said. You must know that. If war comes, we will be enemy aliens. You even more than I. Helen opened the windows and the door.
It stinks of army boots and terror, she said. Let the summer in. Let's leave the windows open and go out. Isn't it time for lunch?
Yes, and it's time to leave Paris.
Why?
Georg will try to make trouble for me with the police.
He doesn't know you have a false passport.
He'll figure it out, and he'll be back.
Maybe so, but I'll get rid of him. Let's go out.
We went to a little restaurant behind the Palais de Justice and ate at a table on the sidewalk. There's pâté maison, bœuf à la mode, salad, and camembert. We drank Vouvray en carafe and ended up with coffee. I remember all that very clearly, even the golden crust of the bread and the chipped coffee cups. I was exhausted and at the same time full of gratitude. Not toward anyone in particular, in general. It felt as if I had escaped out of a dark, dirty ditch and didn't even dare to look back, because I myself had unconsciously been a part of the muck. But now I had escaped, and I was sitting at a table with a red and white checkered tablecloth, feeling cleansed and safe. The sun shone yellow through the wine. Sparrows were scolding on a heap of horse manure. The owner's cat was watching them with well-fed disinterest. A light breeze was blowing across the silent square, and life was as beautiful as it can only be in our dreams. Later we walked through the honey-colored Paris afternoon and stopped outside the window of a small dressmaking establishment. We had often stood there. You ought to have a new dress, I said.
Now? Helen asked. With the war about to break out? Isn't that extravagant?
Yes, I said. That's why we've got to buy it. She kissed me.
All right.
I sat quietly in an armchair near the door to the back room. The couturier brought in dress after dress, and soon Helen was so absorbed in trying them on that she almost forgot me. I heard the woman's voices passing back and forth and saw the dresses flitting by in the opening of the door and caught an occasional glimpse of Helen's bare brown back. I was overcome by a gentle weariness, a kind of painless death without any idea of dying. I was slightly ashamed of myself when I realized why I had wanted to buy Helen a dress. It was a revolt against that day, against Georg, against my helplessness, a childish attempt to justify myself. I awoke from my lethargy when Helen stood before me in a very wide, bright-colored skirt and a black, short, close-fitting sweater.
"Just the thing," I said. "We'll take it."
"It's very expensive," said Helen. The dressmaker assured us that it was a model from one of the big houses. A charming lie, but we didn't mind. We walked out happily with our parcels. It was good to buy something you couldn't afford, I thought. The frivolity of the thing dispelled the shadow of Georg. Helen wore the outfit that evening and put it on again when we got up at night to look out of the window at the moonlit city, insatiable, as always, economizing on sleep, fully aware that there wasn't much time.